Hi, I'm Lindsay Hall, Head of ESG Thought Leadership at S&P Global.
And I'm Esther Wielden, Senior Writer on the ESG Thought Leadership team.
Welcome to ESG Insider, a podcast hosted by S&P Global, where we explore environmental, social, and governance issues that are shaping investor activity and company strategy. In this special Juneteenth episode, we're looking at the changing way corporate America is approaching diversity, and race in particular. The June 19th, or Juneteenth, holiday marked the official end of slavery in the U.S. in 1865, but the ugly systemic racism that slavery was built on endures. In 2020, the murder of George Floyd put that racism front and center for the world. And suddenly, you saw companies that had always avoided the topic of race coming out quite publicly to address it. One way that change has manifested is in recognition of Juneteenth. And in 2020, many companies started observing that holiday, including our own parent company, S&P Global. We'll hear more from the company's global head of diversity, equity, and inclusion later in the episode. But first, Esther, we're going to check in with Rodney Sampson. Rodney co-founded a startup incubator focused on supporting Black entrepreneurs, and he's had a front seat to witness the intersection of business and diversity.
My name is Rodney Sampson, and I serve as executive chairman and CEO of Opportunity Hub. We affectionately call it OHUB for short. We were founded in Atlanta, Georgia over 8 years ago. We have a foundation and we also have a venture fund, 100 Black Angels and Allies. It's ultimately to ensure authentic diversity, equity, and inclusion in the technology startup and venture ecosystem as a path to creating equitable shared prosperity and multi-generational wealth creation in the fourth industrial revolution. Also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and also a co-home visiting professor at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke. So wear a few hats, but all really focused on our mission of scaling racial equity throughout the ecosystem.
So it sounds like all of those hats would make you really well placed to comment on this evolution that we're seeing in the way that corporate America approaches diversity and inclusion. I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about how you've seen that change over the past couple of years.
I would say, you know, last year in, you know, particular, of course, centered around the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and, you know, so many more, juxtaposed with sort of the political climate in the United States, you saw kind of like this reinvigorated moment in history around civil rights and economic justice and kind of the correlation between the two. And so I think last year was a very interesting year. And we saw everything from, you know, the super performative gestures of major corporations blacking out their Instagram for a day and, you know, probably spending tons of money to release these eloquently written press releases and statements. And then we saw, you know, employees at those companies saying like, wait, what? You? Not you. Like, that's not my experience.
So as you noted, we've got a long way to go on this journey from performative gestures around diversity and inclusion to transformative. And I'm wondering, do you have potential solutions in mind?
Absolutely. We spend a lot of time working on potential solutions. One of my dear friends is an advisor to Opportunity Hub, and we're now working on something together around DAIS, you know, which is an acronym for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Solutions. We believe that DAIS can be operationalized across 7 functional areas of a business or divisions of a business. There's the board and governance. Of course, we saw more companies adding Black women, Black men to their boards last year. Starting to think about what governance looks like in terms of holding the company and the teams and their customers, even their suppliers, accountable to a standard of diversity, equity, and inclusion in their organization. Of course, as human resources, how are you attracting and paying Black and Brown staff is incredibly important. What does upward mobility look like for them? Then, of course, you know, for larger companies, there's procurement. You can create equity by hiring other businesses, small businesses to do work for your respective company. And for product-based companies like technology companies, there's inside of corporate innovation, there's inclusive innovation. There are a lot of conversations about ethics and fairness as it relates to product development. And then, of course, you have your go-to-market. You know, how are you attracting new customers or users? Are you marketing? Are you investing in the culture? Are you creating reciprocal relationships? And then last year, we saw more investment, you know, companies going to their treasury and saying, look, we want to put some of our money to work. And we do want to invest in Black fund managers and Black founders. You know, we saw investments from companies like Twitter and PayPal, even Foot Locker or Motley Fool and Home Depot. It was amazing to see Lowe's, the different types of major corporations that were actually investing in Black fund managers. And I think there is an incredible area of opportunity and growth there. And then, of course, there's impact, you know, double clicking on corporate social responsibility, double clicking on what philanthropic investments or program related investments look like. So when you're thinking about, you know, your dais and what your equity strategy looks like, look at those seven functional areas inside of your respective organization. And think about it. If you were an investor and you knew a company scored high, this gives you a little bit of kind of inside track to something we're incubating. If you knew a company had a, you know, a high dais score, would you be more inclined to buy from that company, support that company, or even invest in that company? And so we have a theory that until there's capital at stake, whether it's investment capital or revenue, companies aren't really going to double click and actually become transformative in their investment as it relates to their racial equity or diversity, equity, inclusion work. When I say double click, it's like it's a word we use in the tech world, like flip the page, go deeper, you know, do more diligence, do research, or do more of that, like double click on that.
Rodney said that understanding the history behind Juneteenth is important to understanding the ways that systemic racism continues to contribute to inequality in the U.S.
A lot of people, when you start doing the research, so like if you're not in America, you know, you kind of hear about like, yeah, there was this thing called slavery, then there was Martin Luther King, then there was Barack Obama. What are y'all complaining about? And so when you see a Black person show up on an international stage or at maybe the level or in the platform that I have been afforded to create and others, what our ancestors and our forefathers and our mothers, grandmothers or what have you got us to this point, what we have fought to show up to be perceived as palatable or equitable. And when you have that depth of history, and that's why I encourage Black Americans and all Americans to learn that history, because you're like, oh my God, those people overcame so much, but there's still so much that people are overcoming because people don't pass down the negative parts of history.
This long history of inequality comes with steep economic costs. Just last week, S&P Global released new research led by U.S. Chief Economist Dr. Beth Ann Bovino. She looked at the hurdles that Black women in particular face in the U.S. when it comes to educational and professional opportunities. The research found that if educational attainment among Black women had kept pace with that of white women from 1960 to 2019, the U.S. would have generated an additional $107 billion in economic activity. And what if Black women had also been in positions that better matched their education and skill sets? The research found that that would have added $507 billion to the U.S. economy. You can find a link to the research in our show notes.
We also wanted to understand what it looks like behind the scenes when corporations are making decisions about how to approach diversity. To get a better understanding, I turned to my colleague Tamara Vasquez. Tamara is Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at S&P Global. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tamara. And as you know, this episode today is looking at the way that corporate America is increasingly focusing on diversity and race in particular. It's a topic that before 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, corporate America was not really talking about. To give one quick example, I did a transcript analysis using S&P Global Market Intelligence data and found that the word Juneteenth came up once in 2019 in calls and documents and 36 times in 2020. S&P Global is observing Juneteenth this year as a holiday for the second consecutive year in 2021. And I'm wondering, can you talk to me a little bit about what went into that decision?
Sure. Lindsay, thank you for asking the question. Saturday, June 19th is the U.S. commemoration of Juneteenth and the formal end of slavery in Texas in 1865 that was marked by a Union general riding into Galveston, Texas to announce that the Civil War had ended and slaves had been freed. Although it's really important to note that the Emancipation Proclamation had become law in 1863, 2 years prior. So this is a day that we commemorate, but with mixed feelings. Being acutely aware of the tragedy of enslaved African Americans, finding out 2 years later that they were free. So we celebrate their freedom, but really not the systems that prevented them from knowing about it so much later. And we acknowledge the news of the emancipation of a people, but recognize they really weren't provided with the necessary tools they needed to thrive as free people. And we see the generational impacts of that so many years later. So as we talk about the progress we've made, it's really important that we acknowledge we still have a long way to go to create a truly equitable society. So one of our goals in observing this date as a formal US company holiday was reinforcing awareness of its meaning among our people. So through our Courageous Conversation series over the last year, as well as the introduction of Brave Spaces and other discussion forums, we've really worked to illuminate and build an understanding of the challenges facing the Black community and how various aspects of our society continue to reinforce those challenges and what we need to do to make change within our workplace. So observing Juneteenth as a holiday creates more time and space for that reflection. We also wanted to emphasize that our role as a company expands beyond our four walls as we talk about accelerating progress in the broader world. So one of our suggestions for how people can engage is by making Juneteenth a day where allies and advocates can contribute their time and their talents to causes that really accelerate and impact the Black community in a positive way. So ultimately, Juneteenth is personal.
Thanks, Tamara. We've known each other. We've worked together for several years now at S&P Global. You're uniquely positioned, I'd say, to talk about this rising role of diversity in the corporate world. I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners anything about your own experience, your own journey from being someone who's passionate about DEI, but kind of doing it off the side of your desk, to being someone who has DEI in your job title and as a central tenet of your role.
Yeah, so a little bit about my story. So I was raised, part of my childhood by my grandparents who immigrated to New York from the Dominican Republic. My grandmother used to start her day really early in the morning, around 4 a.m, working in a laundry room at a hospital so she could be home with me after school. And my grandfather worked nights as an exterminator in bodegas, what we call small supermarkets here. They were my first mentors, teaching me the importance of working hard, knowing your value, standing for what you believe in, and even when it's hard and you may need to stand alone. I was also a really shy kid, which made me ripe for bullies. I know what it feels like to be voiceless, and that's why now that I have found my voice, I believe in advocating for those who may not have their voice. I lived in a really strict household, very loving, but very strict. And so really, I would play with my cousins in our hallway and in our apartment building. We'd pay office. And then I would aspire to be a secretary. That and Monopoly Banker were enough to inspire me to want to work in business. I studied international business. And when I graduated, the only way I could get an investment banking job was to join as a secretary, and therefore achieving my childhood milestone. I lacked networks. I hadn't attended analytical internships, and therefore I was not valued. But I've always believed, you know, you have to get creative. I mean, you can't go through the door, you go through the window, just get in the house, whatever way you can. Yeah, just get in, right? So I really just worked my way to the job I wanted. I served in the capital markets, companies like Bloomberg, Jefferies, and Bear Stearns before becoming a high-yield analyst at S&P. And like many Latina executives I know, who also had to start as admins and work their way to the jobs they wanted, you know, I did not lack the skills, capabilities, or work ethic or intelligence. Really, this is about creating the opportunities and the chance for people to demonstrate their value and what contributions they can make. So I've had a few roles, but most of my tenure was spent as the global head of private equity and transactions, where I managed billions of data points a year, hundreds of people in seven countries responsible for collecting and publishing deals and funds using emerging technologies like robotics, process automation, and machine learning. You know, and so going back to your question, right, how does that position me in this role? I actually think this has really helped me in this role because I have experience managing large international teams. The DE&I are global. You know, the concepts of equity and inclusion are universal. These apply everywhere. And so having my own experience as a Latina and, you know, working professionally with people across the world enables me to do this in a very intentional way, and understanding the role of a manager as well. For D&I programs to be effective, I really believe that D&I needs to be viewed as an innovation and business transformation center. We know that when leaders create the conditions for people to be creative, for new insights to emerge, and for diverse perspectives to be heard, that's when we get the good stuff, you know? I sincerely believe that the companies that can tap into what makes them special and unique and innovate are the ones that are really going to truly make an impact in the space. I also think that having been a data tech leader using technologies like RPA, artificial intelligence, machine learning, I think a lot about people of color who tend to get in on the ground floor like I did, and how the future of work can impact those entry-level gateway positions for underrepresented people, to get into large organizations the way that I did. And I also think that, you know, we really need to understand ESG and the markets in order to allow for the alignment of internal programs and external research, as well as, you know, the trends that are taking place in the financial markets.
Thank you so much for sharing your personal story with listeners. You know, you talked about how you found your way in through the window when the door wasn't available. Now that you're in the role, what new challenges are emerging as the corporate world really wakes up to the importance of DEI?
Yeah. So I'll say just a couple things on that. I think DE&I has to be available to everybody. Identity is fluid. And one of the challenges that we see are that some groups will need more advocacy than others. We don't want anyone to feel left out of the process. We need everyone involved in this work. There are so many people who still have not done the work to understand the experience of other people. You know, I hear the case all the time, why are we choosing color or gender over merit? This is not a binary choice, right? I can be both a Latina and exceptional, right? And the best person for a job. And so I think, you know, one of the challenges is really helping people understand the nuance in this work. Also the definitions of what role a company is meant to play in the space has changed. It's really quickly evolving. This is a process of discovery and really supporting marginalized communities globally is a really big undertaking.
When I interviewed Rodney Sampson, who's the CEO of Opportunity Hub in Atlanta, he talked to me about the importance of approaching diversity in a way that is transformative and not performative. Do you have any thoughts on how companies can strike that right balance so that they're addressing diversity in a way that is transformative and not performative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to communicate about how you're showing up, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to the experience of your people and the environments and the culture in which they operate. And so a lot of times when you ask people about how can we improve our D&I programs, default position could lean towards, you know, attracting talent. But the key here is, you know, to really create the environment where people want to stay, right? It's one thing to bring people in the door. It's another thing to create the kind of culture where people feel supported and cared for. But ultimately, it's about creating safe spaces for people to really show up and be comfortable as who they really are and know that not only do you support that, but you welcome it. And really, I think the key is to get senior leader support and buy-in, because, you know, the tone really starts at the top. And so we've been really fortunate that our senior leaders have really embraced our people and diversity and are taking the necessary steps to demonstrate that they value this too through their own actions.
So Esther, clearly corporate America is still very much in the early stages of grappling with race.
We'll be following closely to see how companies are evolving the way they approach both diversity and inclusion.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of ESG Insider, and a special thanks to our producer, Kyle Cangelosi. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast and sign up for our weekly newsletter, ESG Insider. See you next time.